Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our contributing editor, Chris Cavas, talks about the USS Gerald R. Ford and his great piece about America's newest aircraft carrier. But first, it was a big week at the Association of the United States Army's annual conference and trade show in Washington, D.C., where our coverage was sponsored by General Motors Defense, Bell, L3Harris, and Leonardo DRS. Joining us now to discuss what was a very action-packed 3 days at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center are Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, an independent Washington research firm. Byron, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
And Andrew Hunter of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Both of you joined us last week to give us a little bit of a preview on what we should expect. Full disclosure, Tony Capasio of Bloomberg did a terrific job breaking the story about the LTAMDS contract. Very, very important piece of equipment. Competition obviously was between Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, and Raytheon appears to be the victor. Byron, why don't you talk through what that big news item, it was expected at the show, and the announcement was not officially made, but that's a story that Tony broke.
Right. Well, I think it was fascinating because, you know, I think what got people going really on the first day of the show is the fact that Raytheon had brought their radar to the show. It was very prominent on the floor, whereas there was really nothing on the Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin stands. And so when the story was broken and then again, you know, kind of confirmed today, that Raytheon had been awarded. I don't think it was a terrific surprise, at least from a market standpoint, that they were awarded the contract. I think what's interesting about it, though, is, you know, where does this go and what does it mean? You know, that they got an award for basically six kind of prototype models, firm fixed price. But, you know, we still don't know what the rest of the acquisition strategy is going to be, how this is going to play out, what the unit cost of this radar might be. I think everybody gets it. It's certainly much more capable than the current Patriot systems. But where do we go from this is still kind of an open question.
Well, that's kind of one of the themes, I think, of AUSA, is there were a lot of really interesting and, in some cases, exciting prototypes on display, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about whether any of this stuff is really going to move into production down the road. And Army leadership made some encouraging and some intriguing comments about a shift towards a greater focus on modernization coming in a couple years' time. Which is certainly, from my perspective, a good news story, something we've been waiting for them to say, but it's still a couple of years out. And my sense from industry is they are still hedging their bets about how far the Army is really going to go in fielding almost any of these prototypes.
Thank you, Byron, for bringing Northrop into it because they were competing as well. But not to sound too positive, but at the expense of sounding more positive. I think that that's true, Andrew, that there is that concern. There are also a little bit of concerns in terms of the amount of skin that the Army wants people to put into the game. I mean, if you look at the FARA competition for the future attack reconnaissance aircraft, there is a sense that the companies have to put a lot of money into this at the end of the day, the three competitors that are in this. But I have to say, it was an incredibly dynamic, upbeat, you know, it was an Army that was very, very focused. We had a chance to talk to General McConville, the chief. We talked to Ryan McCarthy, the secretary. We talked to Dr. Jetty. We talked to Ted Martin from TRADOC. And the message, and all the way on down from general officers to civilians, I mean, it was a service with a very great power focus, thinking, trying to think creatively. I think what General McConville is trying to do in terms of all of the talent management reforms are absolutely on the mark. Try to direct the sessions, you know, and exhibiting leadership that, yes, there are people in the service that might not like the fact we're going to pull in NCOs and officers to fill specific jobs. I thought all of that was really dynamic. I mean, did you guys also get a sense that this was a service that really has its arms wrapped around a problem and is moving very, very quickly to try to tackle it?
I'll start with it. I think yes. I mean, I think the Army with Futures Command, you know, really this goes back a year, but they've really kind of identified lanes and priorities. You know, to Andrew's point, though, I think it was pretty clear from at least where some of these lanes are, the Army's still kind of feeling their way, too, in what's going to be available when, how they're going to resolve some of these problems. I think the whole question about networks was fascinating, and even how that ties into some of the deep strike concepts that the Army is looking at. So, you know, one of my takeaways, I thought the interesting thing was kind of industry stepping up and saying, hey, we recognize the problem set you have. This is the kind of stuff that we can do. There still is ultimately going to be this question about resources. And I mean, the current plan, you know, basically shows a flat modernization budget for the Army. And it's debatable, you know, I'm sure Andrew will have some views on this, whether there's going to be more money or less money for that modernization plan in the future. So I absolutely agree. It was a pretty dynamic show, but I kind of came away with, wow, there's a lot of neat stuff out there, but I don't know exactly where I want to put my chips on the table in terms of how all this is precisely going to play out.
Andrew?
Well, Vago, you've challenged my longstanding status as a determined optimist, so let me give the optimistic take. And kind of building on what Byron just said, which is a lot of interesting, exciting, creative things were there on display at AUSA. And the Army had some interesting and creative ideas that it's brought to the party and that has been put forward in recent years. And I have to say that alone does deserve some acknowledgement and some credit, because you don't have to go back just a few years where senior Army leaders would say, you know, we've gone out to industry to see what they can do, and there's just not anything that's worth investing in. We're going to wait a decade and then we'll modernize because we think there's core technologies that might be ready then. We just don't see a lot out there right now that we find interesting. And that has changed. You know, this emphasis on moving faster, on the Army being more dynamic, on it setting more aggressive goals for modernizing and trying to move the system faster, has generated a lot of creativity. And that was very much on display. But also to Byron's point, right, the question remains about commitment. They have stayed committed to the same core priorities for several years. And again, that's no small feat for the Army, because they're challenged to do that. The way they're organized makes it very hard to maintain that core focus on priorities. They have maintained it, but we're still waiting to see the dollar show up. And right. The question of, you know, in 2 years' time, how much of this will the Army really be able to afford it is the key question. And it's obviously directly related to top line and what that top line picture is going to look like. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. I think that's where everyone is really hedging their bets. Is on, you know, are we in 2 years going to be in an increasing or a declining defense budget environment?
In fairness, I think the service leadership has been clear on what the challenges are going to be. They're going to continue to work to get headroom. Their plan is that the systems that we have now, we're going to shepherd a little bit more into the future before we move to replace them. Let me ask, though, a fundamental acquisition question. So whether we talk to Major General Brian Cummings, who's the Program Executive Officer for Ground Combat Vehicles, or Brigadier General Ross Kaufman, who is the cross-functional team for the Next Generation Combat Vehicle, we talked last week about the Optionally Manned Fighting Vehicle and why General Dynamics is the only competitor. BAE Systems said that they're not competing, and it appears that the Rheinmetall Raytheon team was disqualified because they didn't get the vehicle where it needed to be on time. But everybody associated with this, whether we talk to Dr. Jetty or we talk to General Cummings or General Kaufman, they said, look, there's an opportunity for people to get back into this competition, that further down the road, as we will walk, you know, move toward production, there's an opportunity for folks to get into this. I understand the need to continue to drive competition, but isn't that a potentially problematic approach where you may end up with a whole variety of very, very dissimilar vehicles, so you don't get the advantage of actually a large fleet size? I mean, you may not be crazy about having 50,000 M113s, but there is some consistency in having, you know, 8,000 M1 tanks, X thousand Bradleys, X thousand 113s, X amount of M109s. I mean, you've got fleet advantages to it. I appreciate you have modernization disadvantages, but is the Army getting into problematic ground with this strategy?
Well, Vago, you know, the Army's the service that still buys in large volumes. And so they have the opportunity to get these large fleet advantages in economies of scale that simply aren't there, frankly, for the other services, because they just can't get to the volume that the Army can still do. And so they have an opportunity here the other services don't necessarily have that you pointed out. I want to focus on a slightly different aspect of it, though, which is the incentive structure for industry in doing this. Because when industry wins this prototyping contract, they hear loud and clear what the Army is saying, which is you've won the prototyping contract, and that's all you've won. You haven't won the system, and there's no guarantee necessarily of production coming out of this prototyping effort. And that has some cross-cutting impacts, I think, on industry's incentives. Obviously, it's going to be hard for them. We talked earlier about them having to put skin in the game. Well, how much skin in the game are you going to be willing to put in when all you've won is the prototyping contract and you haven't won any kind of a long-term production deal? It's going to be pretty limited, right? That's going to be a painful and challenging thing to justify to your corporate board. How much are they really going to be willing to invest in that versus something like a longer-term contract where they know the production's coming? And it's more timing on the investment than it is whether you'll get your return. The second feature is you're still in competition, right? Because you haven't really won, as you're doing your prototyping project, you have to keep in mind that someone can still catch you from behind and beat you. And that's obviously very motivating on the performance and execution side of the contract in a way that having, you know, a lock on the program probably will never be.
Byron?
Look, I think some of the platforms, I think it was interesting to see how many JLTVs were kind of sprinkled around the show floor in different variants. Kongsberg had one, L3 Harris had one, I think in a kind of a command post configuration. Elbit had one that was also a configuration. So maybe some of the underlying platforms, you know, and there really wasn't a competing program for JLTV. I get it with the Raytheon missile, you know, it is a prototype and there's still MEADS out there that the Germans and Italians are supporting. So hypothetically, you know, a six unit prototype contract might lead to something very different. But that's really got to keep Raytheon on their toes in order for them to keep the franchise. And frankly, I think, you know, maybe we really are entering an era where, you know, the underlying platform, as long as the architecture is open, you know, and you can swap subsystems in and out as they mature, obsolesce, and new better things come along. I mean, that is kind of a new business model, and industry is going to have to adjust to it. You always hear this call for, you know, we just want stable, predictable production runs, but we're kind of in a different era, and I think maybe that's going to put more premium on, you know, the companies that maybe have a diverse enough portfolio who can ride through some of these cyclic changes in products. Almost, you know, I won't say regardless where the budgets are, but you know, they're going to be maybe more growth opportunities in a flattish budget from this kind of change than people just holding on to their mature programs and running them through the mill for the next couple of years.
You know, one thing which was neat was seeing the competitors for the future attack reconnaissance aircraft. You know, it's always neat seeing something that's, you know, kind of all new ideas driven by the Army's requirements. I think everybody was familiar, certainly with the Boeing Sikorsky approach with the coaxial rotor, the compound design that they have. But it was really neat seeing the L3 Harris version with AVX, sort of to give you a sense of the size of the airplane. And of course, the Bell 360 Invictus that was there, that was unveiled about a week before we saw that. What are your guys' thoughts on the program? Because when we talked to the Chief of Army Aviation, he sort of, you know, made it clear that, look, you know, we don't necessarily need a scout and an attack helicopter. We're looking at this as what is the helicopter we need on the battlefield of the future? And they're going for that scout requirement. The Apache is going to be in the inventory for quite a long time. It has had a refresh so that's not as pressing a requirement. But if you look at what that Scout helicopter is, that's going to have a heck of a lot more punch than a Kiowa Warrior did. It's going to have more speed than a Blackhawk's going to have because it has a 189 objective speed requirement. I mean, Andrew, sort of what's your take on the approach that the service has on this? Or is this going to be another one of those, you know, potentially promising programs that may not get as far as people would like it to get?
Well, I think that they've got four competitors working on
said Abe Karam is in the mix as well with something very different, unsurprisingly.
Yeah. Well, and they're, you know, that's obviously a design outfit that has been very creative for a very long period of time. So it's going to be fascinating to see what they produce. And of course, at this stage, what the competitors are working on is our design drawings. And some of them have made mock-ups. Some of them even closer to having aircraft that can fly. And then they're going to down select to two who will actually go build operating prototypes for the program. And again, you know, the range of the proposals that they received, you know, for something that's a modified commercial helicopter with a more traditional design as far as the propulsion approach to, you know, what could be a very innovative as yet unexperimented with designs coming from some of the other competitors. They've really got the full range in play. And, you know, to me, I kind of wonder from a game theory perspective, you know, how the Army in narrowing down to two makes a decision about what it wants to have in the competitive space for FARA in particular. Because you could, you know, just as notionally, you can imagine them picking, you know, something that is lower risk, more traditional approach, and then maybe, you know, something that's more of a Hail Mary pass. Or they could just take a lower risk approach and, you know, pick two very seemingly low risk approaches and try and have them do a shootout. And I have to say, when you look at the, you know, the way these RFPs are structured, there is such a focus on cost, particularly with the FARA, that, you know, it certainly seems to me like they're moving more towards a cost-based shootout, and they're going to want to minimize risk. But that did not discourage people from bringing forward pretty innovative and new designs. So it's going to be a fascinating one to watch. And it was, you know, seeing the mock-ups at AUSA was fascinating.
Two of the competitors here are experienced helicopter makers. Bell went to great lengths to talk to us about how the 525 approach carried over into this platform to be simple, supportable, reduce cost, make it something that delivers the requirement, but also gives the reliability. The AVX Harris team is very different. Nobody debates Harris's, L3 Harris's, certainly electronics and systems integration capability. They do terrific work in Greenville with some of the most sophisticated aircraft in the inventory, whether it's Rivet Joint and other platforms. Project Liberty was certainly one of the important programs. But then you got Abe Karam, and folks don't quite understand AVX and in terms of their manufacturing capability. Do you think that we're in a position where a Karam or an AVX can easily win this? Or is this something that is going to be very much a shootout between legacy, Boeing, Sikorsky, two giant names in helicopters with, you know, I mean, for God's sakes, like 80 years of hell or 70 years of helicopter experience, and then Bell, which is really one of the most established helicopter players as well?
I want to rewind just a little bit, Vago, because I'm maybe a little bit more cynical on just the mission for this helicopter. You know, if you listen to where the Army wanted to go with deep fires, you know, the recent experiment that they conducted with, I think, a spike missile, you know, really being able to hit these targets at not tactical, but strategic range. And I just wonder, you know, how this particular platform fits into the type of conflict and the overlay of sensors, networks that could exist in the end of this decade and into, I shouldn't say, the end of the 2020s and into the 2030s. So I wonder if we're seeing a concept that, you know, may be very innovative from rotary technology, but when you really look at the mission of this particular platform, you know, is it possible that that's just overtaken by other technology and investments, concepts that then turn into doctrine? And so I agree kind of with Andrew. I think it is going to be interesting to see how the Army really sets up this, what their choice is based on, down to two. And I think, you know, from the outside looking in, there's kind of this, you know, probability of who wins it, but then the probability of the go, how big is the program ultimately going to be? To your point, yes, they've talked about, the Army's talked about this, not just being a scout helicopter, but actually you could replace a portion of the AH-64 fleet. Now, I don't know Karim that well. Talking to some of the people from AHX, they're all Bell people, basically. So, and I don't think that they're
AVX.
Yes, I'm sorry, AVX. They're Bell people, and a lot of them have a lot of experience in this field. In some of the conversations I had, I don't think there is a question yet of what their manufacturing strategy could be. It's quite conceivable that if their design is chosen and they win the ultimate down select, you know, they'll have a manufacturing strategy. Maybe the helicopter is ultimately built by one of the losers in this competition. Maybe it's built by Leonardo in Philadelphia, which, you know, Airbus, we just don't know yet, but I think that, you know, they're going to think through this. And I just don't think we're in a world where incumbency is as absolutely paramount or as important as it may have been in for this sector.
I think it's an intriguing point and something well worth considering, because I'm sort of along your lines as well, that I think that they're interested in getting the best design they can. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let some of these non-traditional competitors in. And Andrew, to your point, from an operational requirement standpoint, you wonder whether or not this, you know, right, the Army is doing what the Army always does, which is a line up and say the best way to get into an anti-access area denial environment is a low-flying helicopter. But then again, you know, Air Force Association was just a couple of weeks ago, and as an Army friend of mine pointed out, the Air Force spends quite a lot of time thinking through how to collapse very, very sophisticated anti-access area denial environments. And that's why they have stealth bombers and F-35s and F-22s. So there's a question even among some Army friends of mine about whether or not this is the right platform, although I think it's safe to say that the Army is all in on this and the rationale for why this platform is so important. Just before we go, very, very quickly, another tumultuous week in Washington, impeachment inquiry still ongoing. We're still in a continuing resolution frame of mind. A lot of bullishness that this will, the continuing resolutions will basically resolve themselves and we'll have a real budget right around Christmas time. Andrew, you and I were on a panel discussion at the annual ComDef conference this year at the Reagan Center in downtown Washington, a truly great 32nd anniversary of this great International Armaments Cooperation Conference. What's your sense? Where are we budgetarily?
You have to put this in the context of where we've been, and where we've been has been terrible. We've had CRs that go 6 months plus. We've lived through sequestration. So, the prospect that I think there's still high odds that there will be a budget at some point this year, and pretty good chance that when the calendar year rolls around, which is late, but still well within the bounds of recent historical experience that the department is used to of having a budget and an appropriation signed into law, and that seems like the most likely outcome currently, is pretty positive. That's a good place to be, honestly. There's still some risk that factors unrelated to defense could interrupt that, and that we could have a longer term CR approach due to fights completely irrelevant to national security about border wall and other things, impeachment among them. But I think all told, we're in a pretty good place.
Byron, anything to add?
No, I kind of agree with Andrew. I think you almost have to take this a week at a time. You know, the exchange earlier this week between the president and Speaker Pelosi, I might have put that in the negative column for thinking how this budget may come together. But I want to suspend judgment on this. I still think maybe you get something done by the year end. Just to kind of clear the decks for 2020, there's already going to be enough going on. And having said that, I obviously recognize the risk that that we could have a CR or multiple CRs and possibly even a full year CR scenario. I don't think anybody wants that, but all these issues are not necessarily about the defense budget. They're issues outside of defense, but they're going to impact when you get an appropriations bill and an authorization bill for the Department of Defense.
I forgot this question, so I'm going to ask it and very briefly from the both of you. Single most interesting thing you saw or heard at AUSA? Go, Byron.
I actually thought it's one of your sponsors. It was GM Defense. I spent a little bit of time on their stand. I'm fascinated when you see big, you know, commercial companies start getting interested in the defense market. They've made a foray into this really on fuel cell technology, and I think they had a pretty neat vehicle and a lot of very interesting commercial capabilities that they could bring to the defense customer.
Andrew?
I'm going to kind of follow in behind that in the folks that were there that I didn't necessarily expect to see or didn't expect to see there and as much numbers or as big a platform as they were. So in that category, there was a ton of companies there marketing fabric, textiles, you know, Gore-Tex, other kinds of uniform things. So tells me a couple things. One is this soldier lethality thing really seems to have taken off. People actually focused on equipping individuals rather than big platforms. And that may tie in a little bit to where people think the budget may be going and what may be affordable over the long term. The other thing was technology companies. I think they've been there in the past, but they had very big booths and displays this year, IBM, SAIC, Leidos. They were there in force, if you'll excuse a little bit of the pun. And, that caught my attention that they see a real opportunity here. And to your point, Byron, about, GM, that with IBM, with some of these other, there's obviously IT providers are very focused on DoD, but there seems to be this move of tech companies to be very interested in the defense market.
And before we go, one other question. AECOM, Byron, talk to us a little bit of private equity money getting involved in another acquisition.
And Andrew should jump in on this too, but I think it was just fascinating that AECOM was going to spin off their management services business to shareholders. And on the 14th of October, they announced that they were canceling that and were going to sell it to American Securities and Lindsay Goldberg, so two private equity companies. And private equity can usually have shorter time horizons. They're going to invest and then try and turn this investment around and earn a return on it over, maybe a 2 to 5 year time period. We saw private equity also jump in on Cobham in the UK. And, you might stand back and say, we have a pretty uncertain, certainly an uncertain Brexit environment in the UK, but maybe a lot of uncertainties in the US market. So I just observed that it's a pretty interesting time to see private equity jumping into defense.
Yeah, and fascinating that they're looking to see probably either for opportunities to gain market share in the budget or potentially that they think there's real efficiencies to be driven in this part of the defense market.
Guys, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. And joining us now is our contributing editor, Chris Cavas, one of the world's leading defense and aerospace and especially naval warfare reporters. Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
So you wrote an absolutely fascinating story about the mysterious and super secret USS Gerald R. Ford, America's newest carrier. You plumbed the cost of that program, I think about as honestly as anybody could, at about $15 billion. But it is a ship that has been shrouded not only in mystery, but a lot of concerns about what its genuine capabilities are. That the Navy is potentially being zip-lipped about this, not because of the ship's groundbreaking capabilities, but because of its series of problems. Talk to us about some of the things that you discovered in reporting this piece.
There are myriad problems with the Ford, and it starts with just cramming too much technology into one ship. Too much, too fast. And this is not a secret to the Navy. The Navy itself tried vigorously to avoid this situation, but they were forced into it in the early 2000s by the Bush administration and by Donald Rumsfeld, who wanted to bring all these technologies forward and not evolve them over various ships of the class. So they are trying to do an awful lot. They've bitten off an awful lot of things at once. So, you know, it is fair to begin every discussion with the fact that nobody planned this. This is not what anybody wanted. Everybody warned it would be hard. And it turns out that, unbelievably, it is hard. It's very difficult. And they're having, there are four systems on the ship that are well known. And in terms of problem areas, problem developmental areas, there's a dual band radar, there's electrical magnetic launch system and advanced arresting gear, and these magnetic advanced weapons elevators, which are all new technology and all in the ship. They get a lot of attention. What gets less attention is the fact that there's an enormous step up in electrical power on this ship, far beyond anything they've dealt with before on a carrier. So the carriers have, the Nimitz class carriers have about 30 megawatts of installed electrical power for weapon systems, for ship services to use throughout the ship, as you will, as opposed to power for propulsion, which is a separate closed system. The Ford has an electrical system that is over 100 megawatts. And that's a simple way of saying it's an unbelievable amount of electrical power coursing through that ship.
And an unbelievable amount of power would be needed for electromagnetic catapults, new radars, all
Correct.
Of these elevators, and also coming from two brand new generation nuclear reactors.
And the reactors seem to be working pretty good. I'm not aware of any issues with the very secret but still functioning reactors. The power system is a whole other point of thing, and that is, you can model these things and you can test out components of the systems, but until you put everything together in the great big complete package, you're never really sure what's going to happen. And it's a legitimate problem to be dealing with problems. The fact that they have problems should surprise nobody. They warned about this. Everybody's been worrying about it as long as this ship's been in the program. That in and of itself is not really always the issue. The fact is, are they dealing with the problems properly? Can they deal with it? Do they know what the fixes are? Is this whole thing eventually going to work? And because they're so close-mouthed about all these problems, and when they discuss them, they're traditionally, and this goes back for years and crosses lots of tons of personalities, they're not always coming forward with really good information. They don't want to discuss a lot of things. They're superficial about a lot of the way they talk about these things. There's an absence of detail. There's always an excuse, well, I can't go into that. Well, we're still working on that. That's classified, on and on and on and on and on. And what that has done is that it's created an absence of, there's really no credibility to the program. I don't know that it works or not. All we do know is that there are a lot of problems. Ship went to sea, spent its first day from after being commissioned to its planned shipyard period, which is finishing up right now. It was at sea for 81 days. Well, over the course of those 81 days, 10 times they had to stop what they were doing and go back to port for some emergent problem. Not a single moment of that was anybody from any media on board to talk to the ship, to talk to people on the ship, to look at the ship, to see any operations. That's unheard of for an aircraft carrier. All aircraft carriers are just constant parades of visitors and media. And the Navy and naval aviation community is always very anxious to show off their hardware.
How do you think that this plays in, though, to the concern that folks have that the carrier force has bigger problems, that it was a force that was run so hard for so long? Although, right, this is a brand new ship.
Right.
And, you know, so talk to us about how this sort of plays into the broader narrative, because the United States likes to advertise the fact that the aircraft carrier force is the absolute biggest stick in the American inventory that can be used against a potential adversary, whether a small right. one or a big one.
It is the foundation of a non-nuclear military capability. It really is. The number one power projection element that the country has to its disposal are the fleet's 10 aircraft carriers. So this is a very important thing. About 80% of the Navy is actually built to support the carriers. It's immense. It's enormous. So the carriers have to work. They don't work, that's a major problem. This ship, it is a work in progress. There are lots of stories. There are lots of negative stories that you hear. There's a lot of things that people don't want to talk about, and that just brings all this into question. So and it really is complex, and it's, you know, we're not going to explain all this in the next 4 minutes, but it is legitimately difficult. The big problem at the moment that I have is, are we going to have any candor in discussing the ship? Are we going to be, you know, more open? It's the most expensive ship this nation has ever built, period. It would be nice if the taxpayers saw a little more about what they were getting for their investment, and the Navy owes it to the taxpayer to show them more about what they're getting for their investment. So they are about to come out. They've been in the yard since summer of 18. This is a planned, it's called a post shakedown availability, the planned period when they go back to the shipyard and they fix things they found that are wrong, and they add last minute things, and it's planned evolution. It's supposed to last a year. It's gone about 4 months over, but they said they were going to do that. It's supposed to come out before the end of this month, before the end of October, and they will resume trials and developments, and we'll see what happens. There have been several changes in terms of leadership since the ship went into the yard. We'll see if it's different this time.
Let's talk in contrast, though, to, as you point out in your story, how Great Britain has been talking openly and honestly, both about the advantages and what's going well with its carriers, but also what's not.
The Brits have built two aircraft carriers, which are conventionally powered, a good bit smaller, about two-thirds the size of the Ford. The biggest ships ever built in for the Royal Navy, the biggest ships the Royal Navy's built in decades. While they are not filled with the kind of groundbreaking new technology that's in the Ford, the fact that Britain did not build a real full-size aircraft carrier really since the 50s and decommissioned their last full-size aircraft carrier at the beginning of the 80s, their entire infrastructure to do this has gone. It evaporated. They've had to reconstitute an absolutely unbelievable industry competence, everything, operational capability. The whole infrastructure is really immense, and it is a huge challenge for them. It's an immense effort, because there's so much money pouring into this. They have had a sustained effort all along to keep the public informed. Very, very vigorous and active public relations. The ships have been, lots of publicity, lots of media on board. The Queen Elizabeth, the first one, commissioned 2-3 years ago, is now off the coast, U.S. coast, flying British F-35 strike fighters, and they're having U.S. media out again as they did last year. Bago, I think you were the benefit of one of those trips, where they fly people out to the ship at sea. You watch operations.
Extraordinary. It was an extraordinary trip. As somebody who covered that since inception all the way to completion, I think it's one of the most consequential ships any Navy has built in a long time, but we're going to talk about that in a separate program.
Prince of Wales, the second ship, left its building yard on September 19th to live video, the first time they ever got away from the pier. It could have gone wrong, but they actually put it out on live video on the web, and they're still at sea. They've been out for now almost a month. Incredibly impressive. First time underway. They've not gone back to the shipyard. Very, very impressive. And there's been media coverage, and these ships are not without their problems. They certainly have had problems, but they've been more forthcoming about problems with the ships than certainly the U.S. Navy with the Ford. And it's a stark contrast. They actually have far more to lose. Proportionally, the country is, the investment in those ships is far, far greater for Britain than the investment on the Ford in the U.S.
Quick shout out to Tony Capasio. Tony of Bloomberg. Tony wrote the story about the main thrust bearings some time ago, which also has been a challenge on the Ford. Let me take you directly to the big question about how the Navy has responded to your story.
Right. I've heard it both ways. I've heard people say that's fair. Can't argue with that. You're right. And I've heard we are changing. We're not doing that anymore. We're going to be more open. Maybe so, but in many ways, it sort of comes off as, you know, as a sports team, and it's good in the off season to make some changes and talk about how it's all going to be different this year. We got a new team and all that stuff. Everybody's a winner in the preseason, but when the Ford leaves Newport News Shipbuilding in a couple of weeks, hopefully, it'll be another season, and they'll have a chance to show if they're going to be better or not. Maybe so, but right now, talk is talk, and we're still waiting to see how this plays out.
In about 30 seconds, is it too early to tell whether this ship is a turkey or not? And that is just something responding to what people are saying. I'm not trying to prejudge it. Because only two of those 11 elevators are functioning right now.
And they'll probably get about six working in some, which is about half. They have 11 working in some fashion. There are systems that they certainly have. The more experience they get with these systems, the better they'll get at using them. Some of that stuff really does have to play out, and that's fair. There are other systems, and you hear stories and rumors and that sort of thing about much deeper problems, and they are disturbing problems. They're disturbing stories that you hear. Whether all those are true or not, I do not know. We'll have to wait and see. But, you know, the verdict isn't coming in anytime soon, I think is a fair way to put that.
And I think folks are looking at this because Huntington Ingalls has such a reputation for delivering high-quality carriers and has for many decades. I think that's also when people are looking at, well, wait a minute, was this the technology? Was this the process? Was this the combination of things? And again, I remember very closely, you and I were working together at a time when Don Rumsfeld was like, hey, just rip off the Band-Aid and let's go for the brass ring. Let me ask you one last question. Washington Nationals, your dear Nationals, my dear Nationals, are now going to the World Series as the National League champions.
They are.
Who are they playing? Are they going to win?
Who cares? I don't care. I'm of an age where I was a Washington Senators fan, and they stole our Senators. We had 33 years with no baseball. We got our team back. I sat through, along with everybody else, 102 loss season, 103 loss season. I went to two games in a row where the score was 11-0 before we got to the bottom of the first inning. We have certainly seen an awful lot of bad baseball and no baseball here in Washington, D.C. It's unbelievable that they're where they were. I was at the game there night when they won the pennant. I can't believe they won the pennant. Of course, I could never believe that the Caps won the Stanley Cup a couple years ago either. So, you know, the Washington Mystics were at the game there tonight. The Washington Mystics, the WNBA, they just won their championship. There's a lot of Caps that are at the game. But right now, the mojo's working. I don't care who they play. Let's go. Let's go, Nats. This is a great team. I'm really happy that they're a good team. They really are.
It's just an extraordinary team. Feels great for Washington. Very proud of them. And as a former season ticket holder, Chris, I feel your pain, you know, when with young kids and sitting there and they're getting their clocks cleaned, it was tough, but it's really amazing. And especially from mid-season on, this team has been absolute on fire. So
it's a great way to spend a great summer evening, but you know, winning is better than losing. Just saying.
Yeah, that's right. Let's keep our fingers crossed. Chris Cavas, contributing editor here at the Defense and Aerospace Report. Check out his extraordinary story about the mysterious and super secret USS Gerald R. Ford. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks again for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Check out our gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Association of the United States Army's annual conference and trade show in Washington, D.C., America's largest military professional development conference and trade show, where our coverage was sponsored by General Motors Defense, Bell, L3Harris, and Leonardo DRS. And take a look at our interviews with the Secretary of the United States Army, Ryan McCarthy, the Chief of Staff of the United States Army, General Jim McConville, Army Acquisition Chief Dr. Bruce Jetty, and many, many more. And October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and check out our first episode of the Cyber Report, sponsored by Northrop Grumman, for useful tips, insights, and more each week. And if you're on the site, please take a look at some of our great coverage from the Air Force Association show, DSEI, and much more. Follow us on Twitter at DefAeroReport, that's at DefAero Report, and like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and also check us out on LinkedIn. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is brought to you by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight, bellflight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again next week.